So, yes, hello, welcome to Literary Loitering, part of the Geek Show Podcast Network. We are the Geek Show's dedicated arts and books podcast. I'm Graham, and this week I've been joined by Rob.
Hello!
Sarah.
Hi!
And Andrew.
I'm deeply offended that I was last.
It's so we can cope with whatever derail you give us as we ask you your name.
I think you'll find I introed myself nicely enough, Graham Williamson.
Yeah.
I've just realised if you went Andrew, then Rob, then Sarah, the acronym is ARS.
So yes, we are the Geek Show's dedicated books and arts podcast, and we cover books and arts news, which normally means some memoir from a member of the Trump administration, right?
Yep, standard.
Yep. This week we don't have that, but we do have an author who believes himself to have predicted the Trump administration.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It can only be Stephen King.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems about right.
It's his area.
This is about the Dead Zone, isn't it?
It is about the Dead Zone. It started off with now this, asking him if the Trump administration is scarier than his novels, and he agreed. But he did say, yes, that Greg Stilson, the villain of his 1979 novel The Dead Zone, filmed in 1983 by David Cronenberg, reminds him an awful lot of Trump.
He's got kind of a point.
Yes, Greg Stilson, for those who haven't read the book, is a former real estate con man who launches his presidential bid, is initially taken as a joke candidate, but wins through extreme right-wing rhetoric and use of violence against his critics at rallies, and is predicted by the book's psychic hero to start a nuclear war.
That's chilling.
Yeah, and given the current tensions with Iran?
Yeah.
Yeah, and China and Russia and... What's that noise?
Yeah, what the hell is that?
That would
is
be...
someone, like...
That's Andrew.
That was me, maybe not as subtly as I thought, moving a bit of fluff in my microphone.
Tempted to leave it in. Shall I leave it in?
Yes.
Sure, why not?
It's as much
contribution as I'm going to make to this story anyway.
It did briefly sound like we had a scary ghost online, which I think is apt.
Appropriate.
There's somebody listening.
I'm pretty sure Stephen King has already stolen the rights to that for his next book. Oh, no, it's another internet ghost.
Not a bus pulling up outside.
At least it's not an ice cream van, Andrew.
did we have an ice cream van pull up during a podcast?
Yes.
Oh, that wasn't me, that was Mick.
Oh yeah, that was Mick, sorry.
That one.
Did you say Shazam again?
No. We're recording four panel and then all of a sudden an ice cream van pulled up outside his house.
There's one that literally pulls up outside of my flat to turn round and it is deafeningly loud.
Yeah.
So that took us all of about 30 seconds to derail completely from Stephen King.
Yeah, God, admit that was impressive.
Anyway.
But I just want to point out, I almost called him Stephen Kling. Stephen
King. I kind of like that.
Stephen King saying that Donald Trump is scarier than his books is, well, the Stephen King novels, they're not really that scary.
Yeah, I suppose that would be impressive if he was saying it as a sort of self-diss, if he was saying, yeah, his presidency is even scarier than my books, which, honestly, most of them are pretty tame.
Yes.
I don't know, they were scary as a teenager when you read them.
Yes.
Even then,
and
though,
that's,
I wasn't...
That's their niche.
Even then, I wasn't scared of them.
Well, I'm not as much
what
as you.
What is Carver evil, Rob?
Sorry?
Said, what if car, but evil?
I feel, Rob, that you had already lived through plenty of horrors as a teenager just through your teenage fashion choices.
I had no fashion choices as a teenager, but the incident with Piranha, that kind of stopped everything being scary.
You can't just throw that out.
You guys know this story. I was about like 8 or 9, and we basically, the family had stayed up and Piranha was on, and I was sitting there just like not 3 feet away from the TV, and it was the scene where the fat guy falls into the river, and then you see the fish start eating him, right?
Mm.
And my brother had snuck up behind me and shoved my face right up against the TV, and I screamed and screamed and screamed and screamed, and since then, nothing has been scary.
Hooray for childhood trauma.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, the nightmares continued for a bit, but...
Speaking of both nightmare fuel and the Trump administration, Melania Trump's hometown, which is just outside Savnica in Slovenia, has unveiled a new statue of the current First Lady. It is by the American artist Brad Downey, no relation to Robert, and it's... Well, I'm going to pop a picture of it in chat and see what you think. See if you think it's a good likeness.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's extraordinarily like her, I think. It's the salute, I think.
Wow. Wow. Do you remember that old lady who tried to...
Oh, wow. I just opened this.
Yeah, do you remember that old do you remember the old lady who tried to do the renovation job on that religious work of art?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, bless her.
It does look very much like badly restored Jesus, yes.
Or Mr. Bean restoring Whistler's mother. Oh my god.
I feel the need to point out for the listeners, the statue is just a rock that someone has drawn in what looks like a pencil, just a very crude face.
Yes!
I mean, the close-up on the face, I had real difficulty figuring out how many eyes there were.
It's slightly ironic, isn't it, the statue of Melania Trump needs a bit more work done on its face.
I feel
like there's a Picasso influence going on there.
Yeah, I was about to say. I'm slightly disturbed by the upraised hand.
Yeah, that's the salute in question, I think. That's a bit worrying.
It's supposed to be modelled on this picture of her waving, but...
Yeah.
It looks like she's, it looks like all it needs is like her hand on a Bible, and it looks like she's taking an oath in court.
Oh, wow, so this could be another uncannily predictive work of art.
I don't know. I think it can only be so long before they reintroduce that way of showing their allegiance to the leader.
Mm-hmm. Yes. According to BBC News, residents in Slovenia have described it as a disgrace. They have called it Smurfette. And said it doesn't look anything like Melania, which, hard to really disagree with.
Yeah. However, it does look a lot like the body doubles that Trump keeps using to convince the world that she's alive and feeling living in the White House.
Maybe. For the listeners, she's wearing a pale blue dress, which is above the knee, with matching sort of mid-calf blue shoes or boots, and then... The dress extends down the arms, but covers the hands as well, apparently.
Yeah, maybe it is an accurate picture of Melania before the surgery.
I think it's an excellent statue, and it easily competes with my favourite bad statue of all time, which is a statue in a Glasgow youth centre, of Jimmy Savile, which it was taken down after the allegations emerged, but it should have been taken down much earlier because it looks like this.
No!
Yeah. Oh,
somebody must own this now. Somebody has this, like, In their shed or at the foot of their bed.
Oh my God.
It's a bit Jimmy Hill, isn't it?
That's certainly a challenging work of art.
That's terrifying. That's something that could easily be a Doctor Who monster.
Yeah. It looks like if Douglas from the Lurpak adverts was also a weeping angel.
See, I'm not even going to bother linking this, but Andrew knows my my pick for bad statue. It's the Margaret Thatcher one.
Oh, I need to say this.
No, you don't, Sarah. You don't. Pigs.
With the pigs.
You do not need to see this, Sarah.
You can hear her typing, though,
jeez,
can't you?
Yeah, totally. That's she's taller than I remember. it does look like her, but I hope it's plasticine. You can just the public can come and help out with remoulding it.
Oh wow! Shall we move on?
Yeah, a bit of children's book news, I think. A new celebrity, or group of celebrities, I should say, has entered the frankly overcrowded, could-do-with-some-thinning-out world of celebrity children's book publishing.
Are we talking like a Hunger Games-type scenario? Because I'm all for that.
Yeah, I could sort that out. Yeah,
can you imagine
Williams in the Hunger Games?
Can you imagine just a lot of celebrity kids' book authors on an island, and there's a publishing contract in the middle?
Yeah, well, let's see how we think these latest entrants would fare, because the new book is by Metallica.
What?
Really? Is it called Enter Sandman? Wow.
That would be quite good, wouldn't it? A little E.T.A. Hoffman influence. No, it's called The ABCs of Metallica. It will be published in November to benefit the band's charity foundation, All Within My Hands. Now, I clicked through to All Within My Hands' website to see what exactly it is they do, and it's kind of broad. It says,
All Within Their Hands.
I suppose, yeah, they do have the whole world in their hands.
This is just begging for us to do our own version of the A to Z of Metallica.
N is for Napster.
No, A is for anarchy. B is for booze.
All Within My Hands
is for crap.
D is for the
that's
devil.
That's the tune that goes round in my head when I can hear that, when you say that title of that song.
Look, does anyone want to know what All Within My Hands actually do?
No, not really.
All Within My Hands is dedicated to creating sustainable communities by supporting workforce education, the fight against hunger, and other critical local services. It's basically Metallica forming a sort of interim government, is what I'm reading from that.
I'm strangely for this.
See, I don't mind if Metallica want to be in charge, you know? I just hesitate at Lars Ulrich being in charge.
Yeah, I guess we've had bad enough experiences with coalition governments to know that the overall governmental structure cannot necessarily dilute one person's bad ideas.
Well, there's that, but there's also the fact that his first name is Lars, and I know it's a common name in Sweden or Norway or wherever, but, you know, it also has, like, R's in it, so...
I think given the state of bizarre governance in this country and across the pond, frankly, a government formed by a band, why not?
Yeah.
Surely you two are partway there anyway.
Well,
yes.
I just don't want us to go from Trump to ours, that's all.
Yes, you set up the joke well and you followed through.
Oh...
So, I mean, if, listeners, you're as pessimistic as we are about the current British political situation, you're probably going to be looking for some escapist literature about the future, right?
Yeah.
About the future, right? Or
well, a little from column A. Well, I have exciting news. German science fiction authors have found an exciting new jumping off point for their dystopian novels.
Are we still talking about the future right here?
Again. Yes. German science fiction novelists have inspired to create horrible dystopias by, drumroll, us!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What, us, as in the four of us on... I was going to say the four of us on literary
lightning. The world?
It could just be this podcast, couldn't it?
yeah.
We're living through a dystopian nightmare. Fortnightly!
Like and subscribe if you want to hear more. they are inspired by modern day Britain. Sibel Berg has just published her excellently titled novel GRM Brainfuck, which is set in a it's good, isn't it? It's very German. It's set in a dystopian version of Rochdale, so Rochdale, then.
I was about to say, a dystopian version of Rochdale.
and it is themed around Brexit. A month later, Regine Bott published The Shelter, about a separatist English state trying to control an antibiotic-ridden disease by apportioning healthcare via class. And Tom Hillenbrand has just published Hologrammatica, a hard-boiled thriller set in 2088, where England has joined Eurus, the federations of Europe and Russia.
Oh, wow.
Oh, we could have a fun new game.
Yeah?
Dystopian German novel, or actual conservative government policy.
Oh, yes, that's genius.
I want this game.
Well, I think there's been a kind of a climate, almost Weimar, in recent months and years, and I fully expect to be having some literary art coming out of this.
Yes, apparently in The Shelter, as yet uninfected citizens forced to live inside a protective dome and are fitted with miniature wrist tablets that live stream their biological data, and you know, hasn't the NHS just signed a contract with Alexa?
Yeah. Yes, it has.
Asked why this has been such an inspiration for German novelists, Sibel Berg comes up with a ringing endorsement of our recent government, saying, "For me, England is the model country in the Western world when it comes to the triumph of neoliberalism and digital surveillance. You can find poverty in every one of the collapsing countries of the Western world. But the unsentimental removal from sight of an entire part of the population because it is no longer of use in the value appreciation chain, that is unique to England. You see, we're number one."
Yes.
Aww.
And 2 World Wars and 1 World Cup.
Yes. Yeah, doodah.
Sad doodahs.
The irony is, you know the bit that they're talking about? The bit that's disappeared from view?
Mm.
It's all in the north?
Yes. I mean, there was that time when a spoof website published a piece saying that the northern powerhouse was moving its offices to London.
Yeah.
And then that literally happened in reality.
Yeah.
God. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why BBC does documentaries like The Mighty Red Car or something like that.
Mm.
Oh, we are Middlesbrough.
Yes. Hillenbrand's previous novel, it ought to be pointed out, was called Drone State, and that was published before the EU referendum. It might still have some predictive value, though, because he notes that what's funny about reading it now is that even though it's set 40 years into the future in a climate change ravaged future Europe, Britain still hasn't left the EU.
Yep.
So it is accurate.
Yep. Now, we've done a bit of political stuff, so I think we should tip our hats to a master of the form, a groundbreaker in putting the political in English letters, Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay.
In a piece of news which is designed to fill this week's quota of depressing metaphors for the failure of the 1960s counterculture, Hunter S. Thompson's cabin, where he wrote, is now up on Airbnb.
Huh.
How? How?
Well, as you know, I'm an expert in how Airbnb definitely works. They put out a homing pigeon with a message tied to its leg that said, "Parasites, come stay in the house of Emeritus Fellow, and now you can stay there."
Can you imagine just...
I think I read that in the news, actually.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if you go there and you stay and you think, okay, I'm going to be a great author like Hunter S. Thompson. I'm going to be a great writer like Hunter S. Thompson. I'm going to channel the spirit of Hunter S. Thompson. Oh, f***. I'm channeling the spirit of Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes, when you say the spirit, you really mean the spirits.
Yes, because there was way more than one.
Yeah.
Oh, slash demons.
Could you just imagine, though, that, like, the white middle-class trust fund brat who smoked maybe one marijuana and now is going to be the next big journalist arrived at Hunter S. Thompson's sacred cabin, ready to let the inspiration flow through him. But then the doors of the wardrobe slowly creak open, and surprise, it was Johnny Depp's cabin all along.
See, I was going to go with something similar. They go in as, like, the trust fund brats, but they come out as Johnny Depp. It's a Johnny Depp cloning machine.
I mean, we sort of don't have to wonder about what sort of person would go there or what their work would be like, because the article from The Guardian where I found this out is an article by someone who did go there and did try to write there. He's called Kevin E.G. Perry. And I have...
Kevin, for example, Perry?
Yeah, he's called Kevin and Perry.
No, surely he is just, like, the ultra Kevin. He's just Kevin, e.g. Perry.
Yeah, Kevin, for example, Perry.
I think it's fair to say, as much as I do like Hunter S. Thompson, I have absolutely no interest in reading anything written by someone who went to his cabin to write.
No, I understand that.
Like, I absolutely goddamn guarantee you James Frey is making a booking enquiry right now.
Who's James Frey?
James Frey was that guy who wrote A Million Little Pieces, the memoir about how he was proper hard and did all the drugs, which was later disproved, and it was revealed that he was an absolute girl who had had half an Advil once.
Is he from, a trust fund, Oxbridge type person?
He was American, but basically, yes, he was back in the news again last year, as I'm sure Andrew will remember, when his book Katerina won the Bad Sex in Fiction Award.
Yeah. Ah, cool. Ah. Long live the Bad Sex Award.
It was a good one, too. It beat those two majors.
The two majors. Beat the two majors off, yeah.
Yeah, the sexy concertina.
Yeah.
Oh, what was the opening line for that one? Engines to full or something?
We'll have to look this up. Bad Sex Awards 2018. The contenders in quotes, yes.
That was the military one, wasn't it?
Yep.
It was, yeah.
Oh, man, that was terrible.
Ironically enough, the episode we covered that on, I found the picture of that book as well.
And it did look like The Four of Us, didn't it?
Weirdly.
Empty my tank.
That was it.
I begged for
reference. Oh, no! Oh, God, it brought the squirming back. The squirming, I tell you.
It includes the words balls deep. The first time any English language author has written the words balls deep since, I think, St. Geoffrey of Monmouth.
Anthropophagi sex, yay!
Can we call this episode Balls Deep with St. Geoffrey of Monmouth?
We might be cutting it a little bit fine with that one.
I don't know. I think the greater crime is to not.
Yes. Deprive the world of that. Why would you?
The James Frey one was the one that just ended up in like one word sentences towards the end. It ended with one white God, come, come, come. I closed my eyes, let out my breath, come.
Oh my God.
Stop. God, that one.
Yeah, your delivery is not quite as good as Andrew's on that one.
Oh, I can see that all coming back. Oh, I feel a bit sick now.
Yeah, this is why I leave it to the professionals.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
A cabin in the woods. What could go wrong?
Let's hope that everyone who goes there is attacked by a merman.
Now, whenever I see that film, right, I'm going to imagine, you know, the giant arm is basically Hunter S. Thompson's.
Get off my legacy! So, here's a strange story that I don't know quite what to feel about. And it follows up something that we mentioned on the show a bit back, which was the Staunch Prize, a prize for crime fiction where no violence against women plays a part in the plot.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
They were criticised by a lot of crime authors, including Val McDermott and Sophie Hannah. And now they've got themselves into a bit more trouble by putting the following passage on their website. Fictional stereotypes of night stalkers, dark alley attackers, serial killers and menacing strangers are dangerously misleading where 90% of rapists are known to the victim and the majority of women murdered knew their killer. That this can so seriously affect justice for women is alarming, to say the least, and must be addressed. For these reasons, and because we love great writing, we invite thriller writers to bring out strong stories that don't resort to the same old clichés. So, many crime writers have reacted with surprising negativity to the allegation that they are ruining rape trials.
Flipping it.
I'm really confused now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bit of a nuclear take, as the kids like to say nowadays.
Yes. Or nuclear, if you're American.
Yes.
Nuclear.
So I don't know how to feel about this. I mean, I think saying that rape trials go amiss because of Mohider novels is a bit div.
I'm sorry, but that I didn't mean to laugh there because I know it's a serious topic, but the way you phrased it, just it was inherently clownish.
Yes,
you know, when you say it out loud.
That said, some of the backlash against the Staunch Prize has been a bit overstated as well. Like, for example, Sarah Hillary, a crime author, has described the Staunch Prize as a gagging order and said, "Violence against women takes many forms, perhaps the most insidious of which is censorship. We're discouraged from going to the police in case we're not believed, taught to expect resistance to our version of events, silenced by shame or fear. This prize reinforces all those negative messages." Now, you know, when somebody says crime novels cause trials to collapse, the correct response is not literary prizes cause women not to report their assaults to the police.
Yeah, this is turning into one of those ham-fisted internet arguments, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's turning into the Iran-Iraq war of debates about crime fiction where you just wish both sides could lose.
at some point, Godwin's law will rear its ugly head if this is other internet argument.
It is heading there, isn't it?
Yes.
You've reminded me that the Nazis did actually set up a prize in, I think, 1936 for the best work of art that accurately reflected Nazi ethos. And then it closed down in 1937 because they could not find a prize-worthy work of art that reflected Nazi ethos.
Not only that, 1936 was the Berlin Olympics, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so they had Riefenstahl there and they were still struggling.
Well, I'm not surprised because, what was his name? The black runner from America who basically beat the
Jesse
pants
Owens. Up.
Yeah, Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
Kind of proved the whole theory about the Aryan race being superior and everything wrong.
Yeah, so I suspect this debate over the Staunch Prize will run and run, and the fact that both sides are now accusing each other of basically facilitating rapists getting away with it signifies that the debate isn't going to go uphill from here, is it?
No.
Yeah, I think maybe we take both sides. Stick them in a room. We lock the big heavy metal doors and then just kind of leave.
Yes!
We'll just be sitting there having dinner one day going, did I forget something?
Those big heavy metal doors have been installed by Metallica in their new government.
Yes!
I thought D was for devil, but no, it's for door.
If Metallica promised to put all internet flame wars in a special containment unit, you'd have to vote for them.
There should be a physical, real-world side to internet battles. They should have to fight it out, maybe in a tank governed by Metallica. I mean, is that asking too much?
Flame wars should be very literal.
Yes.
See, I am all for gladiatorial combat to settle an internet flame war. I think that it would add more value to the internet flame war for a start. People would be more careful about what they're saying to other people.
Yes. Which takes us very neatly onto our next story, which is about that rarest and most newsworthy of things, an argument on Twitter.
Oh, well, I've heard of it, obviously.
What is this? I've never heard of an argument on Twitter. You lie. Twitter doesn't have arguments.
Yes. Yeah, this started promisingly with someone retweeting an article by Zoe Williams in The Guardian saying that Alabama's new genuinely abhorrent laws on abortion were reminiscent of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. At which point another user of Twitter said, seems like you and me were watching very different shows. Now, this in itself is not unusual. Woman gives opinion on politics on the internet, man turns up to tell her she is wrong. What is unusual is the identity of the woman this man was lecturing about the meaning of The Handmaid's Tale. Would anyone like a guess as to who it was?
Oh, no.
Please say it wasn't. Not.
It is though, isn't it?
It totally is. It's Margaret Atwood.
Oh. Wow.
I will not give the name of the guy who said this because he's been trying to prove that he's not mad, actually laughing about all the attention he's getting. And I just want him to be alone for a bit to think about this. But I will read out a tweet by Chana Mack in response, which simply said, blessed are those who check the bio before commenting.
Problem is, that's almost an impressive level of, like, mansplaining idiocy.
It is approaching legendary levels of ignorance, isn't it?
It really is. Mm. Imagine if Twitter had been around during Orwell's time.
Oh,
people could have given him their terrible 1984 takes in real time.
Do you know what I would have loved to have seen was the ancient Greek philosopher's version of Twitter? Because that would have been just the most amazing thing. Because I've noticed everyone on Twitter who ends up in an argument is some kind of closet philosopher of some sort.
That's true, actually. Socrates would be having arguments with someone whose avatar was a bust of Socrates, like every douchebag on Twitter.
Yes. I'm amazed that Kevin Sorbo, film critic, hasn't got involved yet.
Kevin Sorbo's good enough at disgracing himself on Twitter without anyone else getting in on the act. But yeah, to finish, we do have a crime story.
Is it the worst success of mankind?
It's something that I'm going to spoil it for you. It doesn't feature any violence against women, but, you know, other than that, it's...
there is violence, though. There
it's pretty harrowing, and it has been compared to the work of Jack the Ripper.
Go on.
What's even stranger is that, unlike most crimes, but like all crimes that happen on ITV1, it's happened in a small seaside village.
Ooh.
Excellent.
It's in Herne Bay, Kent. Around 180 offences have been reported, and the police believe it could be the work of the same person.
That's prolific.
180 offences?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And according to this excellently written article I found about it in The Sun, and I swear to God this is a direct quote, there are fears that just like Jack the Ripper, culprit will never be caught.
My goodness, that's pretty serious.
But isn't that 180...
The crime that is being compared to Jack the Ripper is the last pages of books are being ripped out.
What?
That,
yes,
yeah, that...
That is just as bad as murder.
Yeah.
So, the Herne Bay Ripper.
The Herne Bay Ripper is, emphasis on Ripper. He has targeted the charity shop Demelza, which, again, in Sunnies, raises funds for sick kids. says that the man has damaged several books a week over the past 3 months, and his MO includes tearing the last pages so readers cannot find out how the book ends.
But charity shops normally have staff in them.
That's what I can't quite figure.
Well, it's an L-shaped room. I mean, it's not the book. That's not the book. I mean, the bookshop itself is an L-shape, and apparently it's round the corner that the wickedest of crimes take place.
So then move the shelves.
You can't just have an empty bit of a charity bookshop.
No, I'm not saying you have an empty bit. You basically just rearrange the shop, just basically close it for a day, rearrange the shop around so the books are right in front of the of the till. So whoever's...
But then the terrorists win, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, joking aside, I'd be peeved if I got a book from a charity shop and the ending was ripped out, unless it was Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, in which case I would be grateful for them for removing that awful last chapter.
They wouldn't have removed the last chapter, though, just the last page.
I'd like to think that even a madman who's been compared to Jack the Ripper has some sort of discretion.
What if it is just Stanley Kubrick? Just finding out the
fucking place. Hang on, did someone stay in his cabin and summon the spirit of Stanley Kubrick?
Yes. And that someone was Denny Villeneuve. Sorry, that's an eclectic joke, but I just thought, you know, throw in something for variety. So, we've got a book review.
Ooh.
Indeed. And this has a quote on the back from Christina Henry, the author of Alice, which was the first book I reviewed on this show.
Yes, it was.
I mean, it was exciting to me.
No. I was just trying to remember which one Alice was, and then I remembered it's the reimagining of Alice in Wonderland, wasn't it?
It was indeed. I liked that far more than I expected.
Hmm.
Can you give me a little synopsis? Because I don't think I was there for that.
I can't because it was ages ago.
Sorry.
The episode is still available on all good podcast providers.
Nice.
This new one is The Record Keeper by Agnes Gumillion, and it is, I'm pretty confident, the first book we've reviewed that has a dedication to Frederick Douglass.
Who he?
the freed slave and anti-slavery campaigner who debated Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, probably unless there's something I really missed in that Robots and Donuts book. This is a story set in a dystopian future America shortly after World War III, which was brought on largely by cyber attacks triggering nuclear defences. It's a very strict communal society, which Erica Cobain, our heroine, is studying to become a record keeper of, hence the title. But there are rumours of an underground army of freedom fighters led by a man who's taken the name Voltaire that she must also contend with. And, I mean, it's not really a newsflash if I say that this dystopian novel involves the heroine discovering buried, uncomfortable truths about the apparently perfect society she lives in. But just in case, spoiler warning, that is absolutely what it's about.
Okay, it's already a step up from The Mortal Engines.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny you should bring that up, because when I was reading this, I was trying to work out what audience it was aimed at. Because it doesn't... It's about sort of 500 pages, and it doesn't exactly read like a young adult book, but at the same time, a lot of its moves, the fact that it starts off in a school and uses that as its kind of controlling metaphor for exploring this dystopia, it does feel a bit like that avalanche of post-Hunger Games books.
Yeah, it also sounds like the author's watched far too many anime and read far too many manga.
So, watched one anime and read one manga. I don't actually believe that. I just like needling Rob about him liking anime.
I'm not needled, because I like good stuff.
I watched an anime once.
Was it terrible?
I was going to make a joke about him being a voyeur, but you beat me to it, Grim.
No. The Record Keeper is quite an odd book. I can't quite fathom out who the target audience are. I think the characters are kind of thinly drawn. Everyone talks in much the same way. You have to pay close attention to the status that they have in this future society in order to differentiate people. There isn't really that much of a linguistic difference between people who've been brought up to faithfully serve this society and people who want to blow it all up, which is a bit odd. I have to say that the drawing of the society itself is pretty original. It's not a matter of, you know, it being split across a contemporary racial or class divide that's just been held over into the future. There is a believable future society that has its own set of prejudices. And some of the future slang is honestly pretty good. I am actually planning to use in real life the one where people ask each other what they're stressed about by saying, "What's the vex?"
You know, I do like that.
It's pretty good. But these are grace notes, and there's just a lot of book. I mean, there's a point on page 80, which I'm going to read out, because this is kind of the problem with the book. I shook my head. "I've heard of Voltaire. I don't know much, but I've seen the name and I read about the uprising in Hannibal," I admitted. "But what does that have to do with the seed you keep mentioning?" "The new seed," he corrected. "And if you really don't know, it started early last year. A genetic engineering firm, a private company in the Northridge, published a paper. I'm not clear on all the science, but basically they genetically altered a soybean plant so that it grew with much less effort. After publishing, they got funding to alter all sorts of plants. They're stockpiling the modified seeds for use in the Congo." I frowned. "You say these new seeds grow with less effort. What do you mean?" "Less effort," Jetson said, staring expectantly. "Less water, less fertilizer, less light, less tending by humans." I inhaled. "You mean the field hands?" He nodded. "With this new seed, the second brothers could work half of the time and produce just as much food. that's quite a lot of words to say they've got this new soybean that's easier to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this...
So you think maybe it could have been, you know, a third shorter?
It could definitely do with a hard edit. And there are parts of it that I think are interesting but underexplored. You know, we see excerpts from Arika's history of the society she lives in, which, you know, it is quite promising. I would like to hear more about how World War III was basically started by Stuxnet, or the equivalent thereof. But it's just... It is that thing where it's padded where I didn't want it to be padded, and it's disappointingly brief when I wanted it to go all in.
It sounds like a really bad-fitting pair of boxer shorts.
Yeah. As a qualified literary critic, that was exactly the metaphor that I was going to use. So, yeah, I think there's some lovely ideas in it. But the tropes it goes through are essentially the same ones you get in stories of members of the privileged elite in dystopian societies finding out that their world isn't all it's cracked up to be. And if this was a film, and, you know, this heroine who is written as a woman of colour, if it was a film and you could actually see, say, Letitia Wright or Amanda Stenberg going through all this, it might feel appreciably different to how it normally plays out, because you could at least see them and see an actor of colour getting the chance to play an arc they don't normally get. But in book form, I was going through a lot of it thinking, yep, that's The Hunger Games, that's Metropolis, that's not in a sort of culpable way. I don't think it's plagiaristic, but it has a lot of elements which made me think, yeah, I've sort of seen this before. And I wish someone could have steered Agnes Gamillion towards the more original ideas about the setup of the society that she does underexploit.
Yeah, I mean, just the way you've been explaining it, it sounds like, what was that Matt Damon movie where he had, like, the exosuit on it? Had Sigourney Weaver, was it? As the
Elysium.
Elysium. It sounds a bit like that.
I thought it was Jodie Foster, not Sigourney.
Was it Jodie Foster, sorry?
It was, yes.
They're kind
Jodie
of...
Foster doing every accent.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I kind of enjoyed Elysium, but I'm a sucker for Neil Blomkamp's kind of junky 2000 AD comics aesthetic.
See, I liked Elysium. I hold my hands up. I think it's a good, solid sci-fi.
I think Neil Blomkamp is probably the director who I enjoy the most, despite knowing that his films are objectively a bit bad.
Yeah, I mean, to sort of bring it back to the central point, I liked Elysium. I would not read the official tie-in novel if such a thing exists.
No. This book also kind of reminds me, though, of City of Ember.
I've never read that. They did try and make a film.
They succeeded in making a film. I think Bill Murray was the main bad guy in that one.
Yeah, it had, like, a very young Saoirse Ronan in it. Yeah. I never saw it, or read it.
Well, it just sounds, I mean, it sounds a bit like that as well. In that it sounds like just about, as you said, just about every other young adult novel of its type.
Yeah, I do think that even if I was in school now, I would have reached my peak for, like, dystopian novels that say, ooh, this dystopian future is a bit like sitting your GCSE mocks by now.
Yeah, I mean, they are getting a bit checkboxy, aren't they?
Definitely.
We need to have a protagonist like this and an antagonist like this, and it needs to do this and this and this, and it needs to be set in this kind of place.
I think one other thing that I've only just briefly touched on is that one of the main characters in this book is called Jetson, so I'm just picturing George Jetson all the time.
Jane, his wife!
So yeah, that's one of what I've been reading this week. Has anyone else had any other things they've been reading?
Yeah, I've been working my way steadily through that Wastelands novel, which I'll do on the next show, because it is, there's a lot of stories in there, a lot of short stories, and it would take far too much time to try and cover today, so I'll cover that one on the next episode.
Yeah.
I've been given Oh Josephine by Jason, which is a graphic novel with about four stories inside.
Jason didn't give you that. I'm sure I gave you that.
Oh, you. So it's a nice sort of, it's like almost, it reminds me aesthetically of The New Yorker a bit, and it has that sort of languid feel about it. So,
yeah. I've also read Procopius's The Secret History, which is mind-blowing. It's like, Theodora of Byzantium is my favourite historical figure, and I was aware of The Secret History because Procopius, who was the official chronicler of her and her husband Justinian's reign, suddenly did a massive heel turn and like published a book of all the most scurrilous rumours about them, including some that I think may not be true, like the one where Justinian gets so angry that he dematerialises his head. But it's like, obviously, I'm biased. I'm kind of a Theodora the First of Byzantium stan, right?
You've lost me kind of partway through the beginning bit of this. I kind of tuned out for like a split second, and now I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, that's fatal. You can't do that, Rob.
Graham keeps using internet words, and I don't care for it.
What? Byzantium and Justinian are internet words?
He may mean Stan.
I do.
What is Stan?
Stan is
a super fan.
Yeah.
What?
The way, you know, Eminem did a song called Stan.
Yeah.
Went off a bridge and died. Yeah, it was like that super fandom.
I haven't got to driving my car off a bridge and dying yet. I haven't done that bit. But
then you're not a true stan. I thought when you were talking about stans, I thought you were talking about countries, you know, like Kazakhstan and Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I am an Uzbek Theodora of Byzantium obsessive, as you know.
All of those Stan countries are obviously just massive fans of some other country as yet unnamed.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, no, Kazakhstan, they're fans of Kazakh, wherever that may be.
Yeah, yeah.
Kyrgyzstan.
Although we do run into problems when we get to Pakistan.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, but what I was going to say was, like, hello, I love Theodora of Byzantium, and I am therefore biased.
Hey, who doesn't?
Who doesn't? She great.
Rocks. She rocks my world, man.
I am biased, but I felt like every nasty story Justinian, nasty story that Procopius was writing about her just made me love her more and more. There is one where she arranges a marriage between one of her handmaidens and one of the generals of Justinian's army. And later she hears the general complaining that his bride wasn't a virgin on the wedding night. So she gets her servants to hold him down while she spanks him. And I'm thinking, what bit of this is meant to make me not like Theodora?
What bit of this was disliked by the husband in question?
I mean,
now people have to pay for that kind of service.
Yeah, I mean, but you couldn't pay for that. I mean, being spanked by someone who is a saint in the Greek Orthodox Church it's very niche, Rob.
Like you said, now people have to pay for it.
There must be an ecclesiastical term for exactly that.
And if there isn't, wow. I can assure you the Japanese probably have a phrase for it.
Spanktai.
So yeah, that's been us. Is that everything?
I think so. Andrew, are you still alive?
I had no idea what's going on for the vast majority of this show.
Right, okay, so we're at the end of the show. If you want to catch any of our episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. or you can listen to them on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Acast, Stitcher, and various other good podcast providers, and all of the bad ones as well. So, if you want to catch any of the other shows on the Geek Show Podcast Network, you'll find them all on our website as well, and in all those other places. You'll also find our Patreon and our shop on our website, so if you want to show your support, you can do so. That's it from us until the next exciting episode of Literary Loitering. I've been Rob.
Do it now.
I've been Sarah.
I've been Graham.
And the word...
Don't tell anyone.
The official Japanese term for being spanked by a saint is Sanctus Spanktai.
That sounds more Latin than Japanese.
Well, it is, Bentley. I just made it up.
It's also my favourite Italian football team.
I'm sure there was a pizza shop called that at some point. All right, on that note, we're going to leave you. So, we'll see you all later.
Here's boy Leroy. Bye.